This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. And it's a very special Olympic-themed On Country this morning because our very special guest is a two-time Olympian for Australia. He made the final in the 110-metre hurdles at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics and also represented Australia in Sydney 2000. Right now, though, he's with the Australian Olympic team in a different role, and that is as the Indigenous Liaison Officer. We're talking about Kyle van der Kuip, and he is our very special guest On Country this morning. Kyle, welcome to Overnights.
Thank you. How are you, Rod?
Not too bad. Looking forward to the Olympics, as I'm sure you are, more than just about anyone. Tell me about the role that you've got, though, with the team for this Olympics. How did you get selected for that role, or did you seek it out? Did you want to be part of it?
Yeah, I actually seeked it out. I've seen an email come through to all Olympians saying, you know, there's a bit of a call out to former Olympians to put their hand up for a role with Athlete Services. And Daniel Kowalski was sending it out, a former swimmer. And it was something I just jumped at the chance to apply for and, you know, was successful in an interview, and they had a good chat. I think they wanted to sort of get to know me personally and get to see my personality traits. And you know, the feedback from Daniel after I got appointed was, Kyle, you've got, you know, the right demeanor, the right, you know, very calm, very, you know, relaxed type of person. And that's sort of what we need in the role. So that was, it would be way back to 2019,
really?
Before COVID hit. And the other development that sort of came straight after that was the AOC formed an Indigenous Advisory Committee. So I put my hand up for that, and pretty much all of 2020 and a little bit of 2019 was having, you know, good conversations on the AOC table around, you know, what can we do to, you know, honour Indigenous Olympians from the past? What can we do to move forward? What can we do to make things more inclusive? So there've been really great conversations, and probably one of the highlights was having an athlete forum where we reached out to all Olympians, and Steve Hooker from the Athletes Commission was part of it and really drove the conversation and a piece of cultural awareness to all Olympians. And Stan Grant came on and did a piece, talked about the Uluru Statement, talked about, you know, the generational history, and it was the first sort of real step into the knowledge that, you know, Olympians, you know, who are very influential people, could actually start to understand, you know, what First Nations people are, where they're coming from. So yeah, that's been the last 12 to 18 months, and now to be actually on the doorstep of Tokyo, I'm nervous, but I'm excited because I see 16 Indigenous Olympians, and I go, oh, you know, my goodness, that's such a highlight, and to have them across 11 different sports, it's I'm so glad that the AOC have got their lens on that, or the attentions on that, because it's there's so many great stories within that 16, and you know, there's some athletes debuting, some are back again, so I'm just feeling grateful that I'll actually be over there to maybe be a friendly face to bump shoulders with them, or, you know, if they need a bit of a chat, I'll be definitely someone there to, I suppose, be that friendly face. But I'm hoping all Olympians go, oh, geez, I'd love to have a chat to Kyle. He's been there, he's done it, he knows what nerves are about, he knows what execution's about. I've got a whole lot of mixed feelings, but excited at the same time.
Speaking of nerves, what is it like when you are on the starting line, you're down on the blocks for an Olympic final? What is going through your mind?
It's something I remember clearly, and I think back to Atlanta and just walking out for that first race at 10:30 in the morning. I had been getting up at 5:30 for 2 weeks to get my body clock ready to race at 10:30, and I had been jumping in ice baths and getting myself physically awake to get ready to run. And that first race went really well. I won my heat. I ran one of the fastest times. And then later that evening ran second round, and then the next day on the Monday ran the semi. Each time, each race, you're trying to go, okay, I'm excited and I want to just think about that last race, but it's almost I need to hit the reset button because I've got to get my emotions, my adrenaline, my nerves and everything in check because I've got to execute. So making that final, again, was probably the hardest reset because you're just about to have your dream come true. And I remember the first race, you're walking out into a stadium that I had 85,000 people screaming at 10:30 in the morning. I was weighing 81 kilos. I had a skin fold of probably about 23 millimetres. So I hadn't had chocolate for 2 years.
Really?
I heard this crazy woman screaming in the crowd in right near the start line, and it was my mum. And I thought, oh, my God, Mum, you got to just settle down. But then it actually made me relax because I thought, well, Mum's just doing everything that she's done from the little ass races right through to the state, the national. She's just screaming her head off, and I have to just do what I've always done, just get on the blocks and run. And so, yeah, you're trying to maybe put your mind at ease and go, it's not the Olympics, it's not the hugest event on the planet, it's just another race. But the other voice in your head is like, no, this is the Olympics, this is the green and gold you've been waiting for, Commonwealth Games, world champs, state champs, everything before this has just been a dress rehearsal, this is the race. So yeah, I'm so grateful that it all went well and I executed to make that Olympic final.
Aim though, to make the final? Because Alan Johnson won the race, he's one of the greatest hurdlers of all time. Did you go into the final thinking, I can win this?
I went in with some higher expectations than normal. I normally would go in and say, right, run your best and do your best. And Mum would always say, go and enjoy yourself. But I'd run the World Champs final the year before and came fifth in the World Champs final. And I'd ran the Australian record of 13:29. So Atlanta was a definite bigger stage and another year had gone past. So I knew my competitors. I didn't feel intimidated in the environment. But, yeah, you got that huge respect for your competitors, but you're also thinking, well, if I control what I'm doing and I just worry about my lane and I execute all the things I've done in training, I'm definitely a shot to be up in the final. And you don't let your head drift into outcomes because you start to get carried away if you start thinking, I'm going to break Australian record, I'm going to really get a medal, and it's all back to, I've got to get a good reaction, I've got to get these first eight strides out of the blocks, I've got to push over the first three hurdles hard, I've got to keep my technique in check. So there's all these cues going through your mind, but if I execute it, there could be something that happens at the other end. And Alan Johnson in 94, I probably went head to head with him in some races in Europe. And I at one stage I was up on him with beating him, and he'd come out of college, I think. And then by the time, 12 months from 94 to 95, he turned into a 13-0 hurdler. And then Atlanta, he ran that 12.95, I think, in the final. So, we're the same age. And probably the one regret I have now looking back, I was asked by Alan to come and train in America. I was asked by Roger Kingdom, Jack Pierce, Mark Creer. There was a whole list of them that could actually see that I was doing their event from a country that was so far away, Australia. And they opened their arms up and said, well, hey, come to America, come and do a training block. But you get stuck in a little Australian bubble sometimes, and the institutes and the system say, oh, no, you better just stay here. Now with more wisdom and more experience in my head, I'm like, you can outgrow Australia very quickly, and you need someone to give you a nudge. And it's not an arrogance, it's more like, don't become the best on the island. If you outgrow the island, Australia, you've got to go overseas and get pushed to another level.
Kyle van der Kuip is our guest. Tell me, what's the attraction of the hurdles? Because to me, watching it, my heart's in my mouth the whole time, because I worry that people are going to hit the hurdle or they're going to fall over. And we've seen that happen. We have seen people in the lead in an Olympic final, hit that last hurdle, and they don't win, and that is a tragedy for them. What is the attraction of the hurdle compared with just racing on the flat?
Yeah, you're right. It's very technical, and you don't have much room for error. You're cutting a fine line each segment in between. To me, that's what I sort of fell in love with when I was at Little Athletics, and I was the kid that was not quite as tall as he should be, and I was not the thickest, muscly kid. I was quite skinny. So the hurdles was this event that popped up at Little Ass that was quite technical, and you had to coordinate your movement, you had to coordinate your strides. So I thought, yeah, I like this. It won't sort of require the brawn and the grunt that the other kids had because they were a bit more developed. So over time, I become fascinated with the technical side of it and met my coach, Roy Boyd, when I was 15. And Roy was coaching Debbie Flintoff to the 86 Commonwealth Games. He'd had nearly something to do with every high hurdler that came through in the early days. So Roy, he was an engineer. He loved the technique side himself. And so we just became this partnership where his knowledge of engineering and hurdle technique, and then I started to grow. 18, 19, 20, I sort of had the right height. I was 184, 185. That's where the high hurdles came in, and we had that sort of partnership for 10 years to get to that Olympic final. And Roy was an honest coach that said, Kyle, if I don't know something, I'm not going to pretend. I'm going to go and try and find the information from anywhere around the world. So he would talk to American coaches, German, Polish coaches. And so my program was made up of all the best that Roy could see, but he could analyze and cut some stuff out or go, no, we're not going to do that. And then also in the strength department, Roy said, oh, Kyle, I don't know about the power and the speed that you need, so let's find out from the best in the world. And so, yeah, it was a program put together by Roy, and he's such a lovely man. He's the godfather of my daughter, and we're still good friends. But, you know, to think that Sally Pearson had tapped into Roy, Yana Pittman had tapped into Roy, Rowan Robinson, who got the final in the 400 hurdles in Atlanta, was coached by Roy.
But they're outstanding people as well. I mean, I don't know Rowan Robinson, but I know a little of Sally Pearson, and I know Yana as well. She was a very controversial athlete, but beyond her athletics career, she's turned into a remarkable woman now that she's a doctor as well. You were at Sydney, of course, as well, and that was where the whole focus of our nation was on Cathy Freeman. You saw that up close.
Yep.
What did you make of all that and what happened with Cathy in Sydney?
It was amazing to see Cathy turn from the young girl that I met when she was 16 at our first Commonwealth. So I was straight out of high school. I was 18, a giggly, bubbly girl that, you know, she got such a beautiful personality. But to see the strong woman line up, bulletproof and ready to win that race, I think that I just felt proud for her. But I'd also got to know her personally, and we'd lived together in Richmond. We'd trained together in Europe. We went to America. Probably my only training camp in America, I went with Cathy when it was something that she did regularly every April. She went over and trained in the States. And the build-up, I think, Cathy handled so well. I think she probably had more expectations on herself than anyone could ever put anyway. I think that's what I learned about myself, that someone could maybe write you off, and that would be like, you know, waving a red flag in front of me like a bull. But if people sort of expected stuff, you're already one step ahead of them going, well, sorry, what you've just expected, I've got higher expectations anyway. So she had that expectations already. You watch her talk about the race, she goes, oh, she looked at the 49.1 and thought, oh, geez, I've run a bit slow, coach, haven't I? And I watched her in Atlanta prepare and execute that silver. So she just did herself so proud, her family, her country. Didn't get to sort of intimately know the pressure that she might have been feeling, but I was standing next to her before that cauldron was lit, and we were there at the opening ceremony, and she was in the walkout gear, but all of a sudden she disappeared. I looked around, I'm like, where did Cathy go? And then the next minute I seen her in that white suit lighting the cauldron. So she had to keep the poker face and keep that secret. But no, she did herself so proud. It was, I'd run my semi-final. I'd missed the final, so I was a little bit flat, but I quickly got over it by sitting in the grandstands and finding a good seat and just watched Kathy run that one lap. And I just thought, geez, if someone could write a script of how a story's meant to be, like this is it, this is the perfect script. And she just sort of executed, and it was a special Olympics. To walk out in Atlanta, I had one crazy woman screaming on my mum, but in Sydney, to walk out, as soon as Aussies seen green and gold, they honed in and they started to yell, and scream and cheer you on. And after that semi-final, the German, Florian Swartoff, who'd beaten me and made it another Olympic final, he turned to me and he said, how loud was that roar for you when they announced you, Kyle van der Kuip, lane 8, how loud was the roar? And it made me stop, and I could see he really meant it. He said, I've never heard a roar for anyone in a crowd like that, And this guy had been at Olympics, world champs, in the biggest stages, and it made me have to stop and think, well hang on, it probably wasn't about maybe the medals or the final. Like, what an opportunity to perform in front of your hometown and in your home country. And when I watch the videos, I just try and turn the volume up and hear that roar. So yeah, that's sort of the memories I have.
As you were growing up and getting into athletics, did you feel that there were disadvantages because you were Indigenous, or do you think you had advantages because you were Indigenous?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad I just bumped into little athletics, and it was a sport that wasn't overly costly. I remember saying to Mum, I really want to do tennis, and Mum had to sort of break the news, mate, we don't have enough money for that. I can't. You've got to have lessons. You've got to
have a racket.
And you've got to get equipment. And so I had to quickly drop that idea. But, geez, I'm glad I just fell in love with athletics and fell in love with the sport. And I think that was an advantage, that it was a sport that didn't cost a lot. I had a bit of name calling at primary school, and being adopted, I was trying to work my identity out, and I was different to Mum and Dad. I had an olive skin colour, and I was saying to Mum, can you get this colour off? I'm getting called names. This is a problem. And Mum, we both had a bit of a cry, and Mum got on the front foot, and she said, right, I'm going to help this kid be proud. And she called all the Victorian Aboriginal community up and bugged them and said, I need help for my son. But someone who answered her call and came to my school was Morris Rioli. And
and
Morris said, Kyle, it's not a disadvantage to be Aboriginal. It's an advantage, but you've got to use it. And I was 11 at the time, and it was almost the first time that it was that permission to be successful and that permission to be proud. And I don't think I ever look back from that moment. I remember the day clearly, and I remember Morris just being such a gentle, lovely person. He spoke to the school about his footy, about his heritage with the Tiwi Islands. But when he grabbed me and he just sort of pulled me in the staff room and said, Kyle, you got to realise this is an advantage to be Aboriginal. And then I Mum just kept putting me in front of elders and leaders. And I met Neville Bonner, I met Sir Douglas Nicholls, I met Charlie Perkins, I met Ivan Gulagong. Anyone that was successful and doing something, Mum said, you've got to meet this person. You've got to meet this person. And it's not a fluke that I'm trying to do a lot of ambassador role model work and set a foundation up. And I post-sport, I've known that I've got to try and pass that one message on like Morris. I've got to hit that message with someone that's aspiring to do something, even if it's not sport. And I think I've been able to do that. And I'm looking at the role with Tokyo, and I know one of the girls that's made the track and field team, Angeline Blackburn, she's been almost waiting a decade to become an Olympian. And she's been a world junior athlete. She's been on Australian teams, but she's never had that Olympics. And she called me in early in the year and said, I'm in Melbourne, I'm racing, I need some help. I'm not feeling great, I'm feeling a bit flat. But come and help me. So I jumped in the car and we had a good little warm up and a good chat and then a debrief after the race. And she said, "Oh, I think you've helped save my season." And I said, "I'm just passing on some of my best. This is all the stuff I've got in my head. Like, I'm glad you're tapping into it." Now to be in July and she's made the team and she's going to run the 4x4, I'm like, I couldn't be happier. And that's the thrill I get. I think it's a different thrill than running in Atlanta and running your own race. I think to go and help others now, it's the same adrenaline rush, it's the same thrill, but it's less strain on the muscles.
Finally then, do you ever think that, you know, those kids who might have called you names at school, they were not the ones standing getting cheered by 110,000 people, and they didn't win the Bachelor of the Year award either?
No, it's fun. It's funny. The guy that did call me a few names at school, he lived in the same street as me, and him and his brother actually did little athletics and actually asked me to jump in the car and go down with them on a Saturday. So from name calling to asking me to do little ass, I was waiting years to say thank you for, you know, introducing me to little ass. And then I actually did bump into that guy. I was ready to say thank you, but he topped it. He said, "Kyle, I found out I've got Indigenous heritage."
And wow.
I never knew about it, and I'm identifying now, and I'm, oh my God. And it's such a common thing I'm seeing now in the employment space and the mentoring space, that the more our country grows and starts to understand the histories, you're also making the environment safer for people to come forward to say, it is in my history. And that was a couple of my schoolmates that actually found out that they were Indigenous. But yeah, for me, yeah, there's a bit of name calling at high school as well, and totally different story. But I bumped into that fellow years later, and he said, "Oh, Kyle, I have to say sorry to you for what I was calling you at school." And he said, "Did you know that, you know, I had a really rough life. I didn't have a great run with my parents, and I've actually been in jail." And he gave me a bit of his story, but I to shake his hand and say, "You know what? It's all right. It's all right. It hasn't affected me." And he said, "I've watched you at the Olympics. I've watched what you do." And I said, "Yeah, mate. It was almost me healing him to say, "It's all right. Don't worry about what you said. If that was through you not knowing enough, then I hope me sort of giving you is the first step of understanding that." Yeah, I enjoy the cultural awareness space, because it's I was saying to a CEO the other day, I said, it's you know, to me, cultural awareness and, you know, you developing your knowledge, I said, it's about confidence. And I said, you've got to feel confidence, but it's a space that people don't feel confident to step into. But I said, also, I can see that you're nervous, and nerves mean that you care. And I said, every time I raced, I was nervous, but my coach said, you know, Kyle, nerves mean you care. So I used to talk to my nerves. So, okay, I know you're here today. Are we gonna run well? Yep. Okay, you're nervous. Well, we care about this. Let's go and get the best result possible. And it's probably in the working space. That's where I see, you know, if someone cares about, you know, working with Indigenous people, then it's going to work. Because if you're nervous about it, it means you care and you want to do the right thing.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for your achievements for Australia on the track. And I really hope you have a wonderful time at the Olympics. You're able to help not only the Indigenous competitors on our team, but everybody else as well. And I hope Australia goes brilliantly at the Tokyo Games when they finally take place. And thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. I'll keep in touch.
Overnights with Rod Quinn on ABC Radio.